Hello, this is Paul Gottlieb speaking. It's Wednesday, March 6, 2006, and I'm speaking with physicist Dr. Ernest Sternglass in the Berkeley home of Lorraine Murray, a whistleblower from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. The two of them will shortly be on their way to Japan, where they'll participate in a major conference on nuclear radiation. Dr. Sternglass has been Professor Emeritus of Radiology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine since 1983. He has held professorships in radiology and physics at several universities, including Stanford, Indiana University, and one in Paris. Between 1950 and 1967, he was director of the Apollo Lunar Scientific Station program while at Westinghouse Research Laboratories. In 1953, he received his doctorate in engineering physics from Cornell University, where he also earned postgraduate and undergraduate degrees in engineering physics and electrical engineering, respectively. He taught physics at George Washington University and held a research fellowship at Cornell University. Dr. Sternglass has received many academic and professional honors, is a member of several professional societies, and holds 13 patents. He is the author of several books on low-level radiation. His 1981 book, Secret Fallout, Low-Level Radiation from Hiroshima to Three Mile Island, established him as a pioneer in the study of the health effects of low-level radiation. Dr. Sternglass is presently director, co-founder, and chief technical officer of the Radiation and Public Health Project. And now we'll continue.
Well, I'm a strange physicist in the sense that I'm working now in the medical field, really, you know, because my early interest in life, right now I'm just following up on all those things. Now I'm a retired professor of radiological physics at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, and I was there since 1967. That's a long time. And before that, I worked for 15 years at the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, working on imaging tubes and electronic image intensifiers to see in the dark, and among other things, I worked on my idea was to use a new kind of camera tube that was the one that sent the pictures back from the moon.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was in charge of the planning for a lunar scientific station, and we were going to put a telescope on the moon that would use this camera tube that would have made a small telescope, a 12-inch telescope, as powerful as a Mount Palomar telescope, the biggest in the world at the time. And so, unfortunately, the Vietnam War killed that one. When that ran out, the University of Pittsburgh asked me to start a new group on the electronic imaging to improve upon cut back the dose of x-rays that you get when you get a chest x-ray or breast examination or
make
an abdominal
it more efficient.
X-ray. Make it less damaging. We knew that radiation was damaging, you know.
You wouldn't say more efficient.
Well, it's become more efficient than a photographic plate. It used x-rays better. And x-rays are just a short form of light, a very intense form that is ionizing radiation because it removes electrons and disrupts molecules, and that's why it is so dangerous. And I was interested in this all my life since I was a kid because my father was a dermatologist and my mother was a gynecologist and pediatrician, and at the dinner table they would often discuss the cases. My mother was very good at diagnosis. My father was very good in, you know, spotting what was wrong with the patient. And so I got an early medical education when I was 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. And among the things my father talked about is that sometimes, on a number of occasions, he had to treat skin cancer on people who had been treated with x-rays for acne. And then he found out that the x-rays are not exactly good for the person, and so he had to treat the skin cancer.
About what year would that be?
Oh, way back in 1928, 29, long ago. And at that time, I remember going into shoe stores and looking through my shoes into my toes wiggling because they had x-ray machines in the shoe stores.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And people, a lot of people got exposed as children by misuses of x-rays in early life because we didn't understand the full impact that radiation had.
I've seen myself through a fluoroscope.
Yeah. Well, the fluoroscope gives you 100 to 200 times more radiation per second than the present image intensifiers that I worked on at the Westinghouse Research Laboratory.
I used to peek around the corner at myself.
There you go. And so for years in the early history of X-rays and radiation, people didn't understand all those things because you don't see it, you don't smell it, it doesn't happen immediately. Sometimes it takes years for it to develop. And so it was hard to understand.
They don't connect the exposure to the disease.
Exactly. It's so hard because today many people dying of cancer, but we don't know exactly what caused this particular person's cancer.
Right.
The cancers all look alike, but the causes can be widely different.
Mm-hmm.
It could be overuse of X-rays, which is often done in medicine, as my father told me, and today we have overuse of medical X-rays and CT scans on children. The doctor wants to protect himself against lawsuits, so he wants all the best pictures, so they take a lot of X-rays.
I know. The dentists are just mad about this stuff today.
Exactly. And so people are always minimizing the potential side effects of what they're working with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true in every field.
Mm-hmm.
But in radiation, it's particularly sensitive. So what happened is that when I was a youngster, I was in the Navy, and I was about to be shipped out to Hiroshima. About when Hiroshima ended the war, and maybe, ironically, my own life may have been saved by the bomb, because hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, would have died in the full-scale invasion of Japan. Okay? So my interest, my personal interest in atomic weapons was very personal. And in fact, the first job I had when I got out of the Navy, I had a side job, a small for a few summer months. I worked as a science writer for science newsletters, and one of the first stories I did is someone suggested we must now rebuild all our cities in a linear structure so that you cannot extinguish them with a single blast that would, you know, destroy a small circular city. Okay. So, early in my life, I became very, very much interested personally in what happens in the atomic age. And being a physicist, I was hopeful that, there would be great benefits from it. And then when Westinghouse worked with Admiral, famous Admiral, who built the first submarine, okay, first nuclear submarine, Rickover was his name.
Right.
And they built the first powerful nuclear plant in Pittsburgh for electric power in this country in 1957, you know. And so I was very happy about that because Pittsburgh was filthy. Snow was dirty when it...
The promises.
Yeah, you know, and it was smoke-filled.
The promises of clean energy.
The promise of clean energy.
Well, there were massive problems with coal energy production. I mean, wasn't there some place in Pennsylvania where...
Yes, near Pennsylvania, people died and some epidemic... where there was a very bad air pollution epidemic, yes.
An air inversion.
And so it was obvious that we must clean up our environment, and the obvious thing was smokestacks.
Mm-hmm.
And today, Pittsburgh is as clean as Ithaca, New York, where I went to college. It's become a college town, you know.
There's no industry there either.
Hardly any anymore. Yeah. It's mostly the medical industry.
Right.
The
biggest cleaning up the messes.
No, well, Pittsburgh is one of the most famous school places for all kinds of advances in transplants and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very personal, too, because my wife had a successful kidney transplant, you see, and it happened in Pittsburgh. So I feel very much involved in this whole thing, and when I was trying to reduce X-rays to people to minimize the dose that you get during fluoroscopy and other things, I found the government was releasing more and more atomic bombs in the 1950s. And then I began to understand that they were countering everything I was trying to do in the hospital to minimize radiation.
Those were tests.
Were just atmospheric bomb tests.
Mm-hmm.
That began first, of course, the first bomb test was in New Mexico, Trinity, in 1945 in July, followed by a few weeks later for the first atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then they moved to the Pacific, and did a lot of bomb testing there. They didn't start it in the U.S. because they didn't want the fallout to go on our people, so the people of the Marshall Islands got hit by all this fallout, and terrible things happened there. There's a big story about that. And a Japanese fisherman was injured, and they went back and they developed cancer, and it was a big story at the time. And so then they moved from the Pacific for financial reasons to Nevada. They picked Nevada to do more bomb testing because it's cheaper to communicate there and go back and forth than way out into the middle of the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually bombed our own cities because the fallout from these bombs reached all the way across the United States. They were telling everybody, oh, the fallout will come right down immediately and there'll be nobody outside the few miles around the bomb, you know. Maybe 50 miles, 20 miles. That's all. No effect on everybody.
It seems to me I've seen maps of the areas that the fallout reached.
The entire country was hit, depending on the wind direction, either up to the Great Lakes or down to Florida, and everyone was irradiated during the time of nuclear bomb testing.
Now, that's just with respect to the United States, but what about the rest of the world?
Well, the others followed. The Russians, we did our first bombs in 45.
No, I mean the fallout from our own bombs.
Went around the world.
It went around the world.
Of course. Mm. But especially when we developed the hydrogen bomb, which produced a much bigger cloud in the stratosphere, and the winds from the stratosphere, you know, the jet winds
got higher.
Much
and
higher.
Therefore
and they really contaminated the whole world much more. But everyone was hit by even the first few kiloton bombs, you know. Later on, there were millions of tons of TNT equivalent. And that radioactivity has had enormous impact on the whole world, which the government who wanted to do this, like the United States, was hiding from the people. Because who wants to, you know that they're killing their own friends and their own people?
No, of course not.
Of course not. You want to kill your enemy.
That's a good question about this. The hydrogen bomb reached higher altitudes.
Yeah, and therefore circulated
now,
much more.
Now, when it's in the higher altitudes, does it cause any kind of reactions up there with...
To some degree, yes.
You know,
yes.
With the weather patterns
yes,
and all this
does.
Sort of
it
thing.
Yes, it does. It has effects on the weather. It can affect all kinds of things. But the most important thing is that it produces many isotopes, many chemicals, when the uranium or the plutonium breaks up into pieces, it creates elements that last a long time. Some of them last for millions of years, some of them last for tens of years, and some of them last for a few minutes. And the ones that last for tens to 20 years are the most important, and they're most damaging. Because the ones that have a half-life of a billion years, they give very little activity per second. And the ones that are short-lived die out before it reaches people. But if you have half-lives of the order of 10, 20, 30 years, that's comparable to the human lifespan...
It's a lot of energy coming up
yes,
very quickly.
And it gets into your bone, like in strontium-90, which is one of the products that gets into your bone and irradiates the bone and the bone marrow.
Well, how does it get from the stratosphere into my bone?
Very interesting. It comes down in a few years sometimes, in a few months to years, gets on the grass. And we have drink a lot of milk in the United
States.
Yeah,
we're really told to drink
it. Oh, absolutely. Every woman who's pregnant or expects to have babies is told to drink a lot of milk. So the cows graze on it, and the cows concentrate it because the strontium 90 behaves like calcium, which everybody needs for bone growth and for all kinds of processes. And even the brain works with calcium ions communicating between the different neurons in the brain.
So are you saying that the body, my body, sees strontium 90 as calcium?
Exactly. That's the danger.
And then it assimilates it into my body as
everywhere.
If it's calcium.
Exactly. And that's why it is so dangerous. Mm-hmm. Because we need calcium, and the cow produces enough calcium in its milk, and the mother produces in her breast milk, so the baby bone can grow.
Oh,
don't you see?
You're giving me goosebumps.
But that's what it is all
that's
about.
That's what it is, yeah.
And in addition, we have not only strontium 90 that concentrates in the bone, but it decays into yttrium 90 in the process of giving off a very powerful electron that travels, maybe a tenth of an inch, a big distance in the body, many cells. But the yttrium is just as powerful, and even more so. And so the yttrium concentrates in the key soft organs. The soft organs include the lung, the heart, the kidney, and especially the pancreas. In fact, about 10 years ago, I discovered that a Professor Segi in Japan at Tohoku University, and he studied the cancer rates in Japan after the first bomb was dropped. And all over Japan, there was a big increase in many types of cancers. And the biggest increase in cancer was not just breast cancer or thyroid cancer, which we know, but pancreatic cancer. It increased 12-fold between 1945 and 1963.
Where is the pancreas in my body?
Well, it's sitting
down in my stomach,
yes,
somewhere.
Absolutely. And so you get abdominal x-rays, as mothers, women got during the time of when often, during pregnancy, the doctor wanted to know, is the baby in a normal position? During the 20s, 1930s, 50s, everybody got x-rays during pregnancy. It wasn't until Dr. Alice Stewart in England at Oxford University discovered in 1956 that women whom she sent out questionnaires to because she was worried about an epidemic of leukemia in England. Nobody knew why. And so she sent out questionnaires, and she asked them all kinds of questions. Do you have benzene in the house? Do you work in a factory that has chemicals? And so on. And among other things, she asked, did you ever get x-rays? And then she asked, did you ever get x-rays during pregnancy? And she found that among the mothers who had children that developed leukemia and brain cancer and other cancers, there were many who had x-rays during pregnancy.
Can we see x-rays as being somewhat on the same level as a nuclear bomb?
Well, that's what
I don't mean as far as an x-ray being as powerful, but
no.
But I mean the same type of radiation affecting
well,
the same.
Well, that's the mistake we all made.
Okay.
You see, that's the interesting thing. Since the only major groups that had been studied were the people who got medical x-rays.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they used to go around the supermarket and places and shopping centers and ask women whether they would like to be tested for tuberculosis. So they give them, a fluoroscopic or x-ray examinations for free. And so a lot of people were irradiated in the effort to stop TB. Okay? Another one of those mistakes. Okay? And there was an epidemic of breast cancer and heart disease among the people. That was discovered many years later. It always takes years to discover it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, too, as a young scientist, having been educated at the dinner table about x-rays, assumed, like most everybody else in the world, that fallout is just another form of x-ray. But it isn't. That's the interesting part. You see, x-rays are waves, not particles. Not an atom of strontium-90 is an atom that now and then shoots out a particle, but it gets into your body by eating it or drinking it or inhaling it.
As opposed to passing through your body.
Yeah, the energy. X-ray goes through, and in fact, the X-ray pretty well nearly uniformly exposes your body. And then it was discovered in 1972, 30 years after the first reactors were built in 1942 in the University of Chicago. What happened is that it was just crazy. This Dr. Abram Petkow in Canada discovered that, among other things that he studied, he found that when radiation was continuously given, not in a flash, in a short burst like this, but in a slow method by inhaling it or getting into your body, and he found it in brain cell type of tissue, that when it was given continuously, the free radicals, which are a form of ordinary oxygen, that attached an electron, and then this became a powerful toxin because the electrons were created by the x-rays. So what happened is that the particles stay in the body for a long time and concentrate in certain organs, like the radioactive iodine, 131 or any other form of radioactive iodine goes to, most of it ends up in the thyroid. It circulates through the whole body, but it concentrates in the thyroid. That's why one of the cancers that has been rising the most after bomb testing is from the thyroid.
Okay, now you say thyroid. That's the effect directly on the thyroid. But if the thyroid isn't operating properly, then you've got other problems.
Exactly.
That go on.
And so many other problems connected with thyroid malfunction.
That's your endocrine system.
Absolutely.
Your endocrine system gets totally whacked out.
You're absolutely right.
And your thyroid does what? What does the thyroid
do? Well, the thyroid actually controls the metabolism. It controls the rate at which you burn up energy. And among other things, it was very cleverly suggested by Dr. Rosalie Bertel, who's a friend of mine whom I knew many years, and I talked with her about this. She wrote in her book that probably damage to the thyroid helps to explain why we have such an epidemic of people becoming obese and overweight. And that's related to other diseases in turn.
And birth problems as well.
Birth problems, but one of the most important problems that had been totally ignored, and nobody knew what's really causing this sudden epidemic of diabetes. We now have in this country, you know, a huge increase in diabetes, and around the world today, 150 million people are suffering diabetes, and it is expected to double to 300 million in another 20 years.
It's a real moneymaker for the pharmaceuticals.
Well, that's why the biggest profit in Pittsburgh being made by the medical center that has to treat people for diabetes. Every time somebody gets amputated something, the university gets, it costs $50,000. Mm-hmm. That's how the university medical center made this money.
Let me ask you a question. Can we go back just a moment to Japan?
Sure.
When the bomb was dropped and all of these people, massive cancers broke out and all this. But sometimes I hear people who like to think that they're dispelling myths, right? You know, there's the junk science website and all these crazy people.
Yeah.
But they say things like, well, the cancer rates in Japan have gone down and we don't see any more problems from the bomb. Can
completely
you talk about
wrong.
That?
It's completely
Tell
wrong.
Tell us about that.
Yes, because Dr. Sigi at Tohoku University, okay, he found and published a paper which I used that cancer rates of every type suddenly shot up after Hiroshima all over the nation because there was fallout all over Japan.
Okay.
And then, not just from these bombs, but from the Russian tests that began in 1949 and from our Pacific tests that began right away in Bikini and all these things. And so, I'll give you one example. Because of strontium-90, which is one of the elements which is produced when fission takes place in the bomb, and uranium and plutonium fission, it turns into yttrium-90 when it gives off an electron. It changes its chemical properties and is attracted to the soft tissue of the body. And so it goes to the lung. And we have an epidemic of lung cancer, especially among women. Since about 1960, there has been a tremendous rise in lung cancer in women who never smoked.
Is this related to the bomb?
Yes, because during the 1950s and 60s, we did a lot of bomb testing. Our last atmospheric bomb testing occurred in 1962. But underground tests in Nevada that often vented through the rock and escaped into the continued until 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese until 1993. And in fact, the Chinese continued bombing in the atmosphere until 1980. So there was a big period when women reduced their smoking rate. And it's in a government publication called Health United States 2003. Anybody can get it on the internet. Okay. And I looked at it, and there's this graph. It shows a rise in lung cancer and a decline in smoking. Okay? So it cannot all be blamed on smoking as we thought it was. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, the doctors didn't want to hear and believe that cigarette smoking could be dangerous, right?
Well, it's all so bloody complicated. Even the cigarette issue is not so clear-cut.
Not at all. You know what the main source of that's being ignored in cigarettes.
I know it's coming.
Uranium. Radioactivity in cigarette smoke, because the greatest phosphate mines in the world are in Florida, in a county that has a high rate of cancer, and it shipped all the phosphates, which are fertilizer, to the tobacco farms, among other places. And so the sticky hair on the tobacco plants catch the radioactivity from the fertilizer, okay? Nobody dreamt about this. This fertilizer was discovered way back in 1880, before radiation was even known. X-rays weren't discovered until 1895, and radioactivity just about a year later. So we didn't even know.
You know what I like is the example of the Kent cigarette. I told you once in a conversation about the synergies between... This isn't a Kent cigarette. Now... the synergies that can occur are from the asbestos that they were using in the filter, and I'm always curious about synergies in this and
that's
that.
Very important.
And it's a nice mix, because the cigarette, without even thinking about the asbestos, is loaded with hundreds of petrochemicals, synthetic petrochemicals, and it's rained upon by all this uranium and strontium and yttrium and all the other stuff. So this is here's a concentrated delivery system of everything from dioxin to uranium in a cigarette, and now they add asbestos to it, which, if the asbestos is in the lungs
much
before
worse.
The radiation hits, then there's a synergy.
It traps it. It doesn't allow it to escape as readily.
Ah.
And another thing that it does, it slows down the cilia. The nicotine slows down the cilia that expel the uranium dust from your lungs.
We love Kent cigarettes. I wonder how many nuclear physicists working on the bomb were smoking Kent cigarettes at
Who
the
knows?
Time. Anyway, that makes a little side story.
Yeah, I know, but it's really very important, because it shows that what often is the case is synergistic action between things, you see? Synergy is crucial in all these things, because the presence of industrial smoke and other chemicals and other drugs in the body have been found in many studies now to enhance the action of radioactivity. And the uranium miners are a very good sample. When they smoke in the mine, they die of 100 times the normal cancer rate. If they don't smoke, it's only 10 times.
Well, if we're living in the modern world, where we're microwaving our food in plastic, and the food is garbage to begin with, it's pesticide-ridden, hormone-treated, antibiotics.
And loaded with radioactivity.
I mean, all the way, and we sit in a car all day that's loaded with hundreds of VOCs.
Right.
We close up the windows and put it on recirculate so we don't get the diesel fumes. And our kid is sitting in a plastic seat with diapers on and chemicals in it.
The technology has always unexpected side effects.
But the synergies is when I hear the word synergy, it just makes me laugh, because the chemical companies or any of these companies want us to look at one specific thing.
Yes.
This doesn't cause cancer. Okay, right. I don't care.
I know. And in fact, all the animal experiments that we've done are misleading, because you only always try one thing at a time. And therefore, you don't get the synergistic multiplication of the health effect. Now, I'm going to Japan to try to explain to them that we cannot keep on doing what they're doing, because they have now operating 53 nuclear reactors in an area the size of California, and California now has only 4, and we see terrible effects from what's happening here in California as well as in Japan.
Now, tell me, where are you going? Who are you going with? Who are you going to see? All this kind of thing.
Well, I'm going with Lorraine Moret, who has been there for about 5 times, and she has met so many of the scientists there that she's going to introduce me to many people in the anti-nuclear movement, the environmental movement, and there's a conference in Hiroshima dealing with the question of genocide.
They seem to be more acceptant to this.
They are much more, because they were the victims. They were not the people who initiated the whole mess of building atomic bombs. They are the first victims. other than the children in the New Mexico that we first killed.
Downwinders.
Exactly. And in Nevada. And that's exactly what we now have to depend upon.
And are you going to be talking about depleted uranium?
Yes, because that's part of it. Because in building the bomb, so much uranium that was not fissionable, the U-238 compared to the U-235, that was not fissionable but was a very heavy metal. And because when it easily burns at a low temperature, and when you use it because it's so heavy as a bullet or a piece of an artillery shell, like an arrow made out of solid metal uranium, then it explodes and burns, and in the process of burning it produces very fine particles.
Nanoparticles
that have a much greater health effect on their own, regardless of what chemical they're made out of. Any kind of nanoparticles has now been found to be biologically much more toxic than the same form in a big particle. Because it goes through all the cell membranes, it gets into the blood, it gets carried around the body when it's tiny. A big particle doesn't necessarily get all over the body. It's, you know, even the uranium miners inherited a very different type of particle. And we didn't appreciate that for a long time, the seriousness of nanoparticles.
So what we have here is this depleted uranium. Depleted uranium is, I won't get into the chemical aspects of it so much, but its weight is something 2.7 times
heavy.
The weight of lead.
No, it's something of the order of 15 times heavier than water, you know, much heavier.
And its
specific gravity is used as a bullet against tanks. It melts, it goes through tank armors. Because it melts it in a way, you know, and it explodes in the process and forms a gas. And this gas is uranium oxide, some form of very tiny particles, and it is, in fact, early was in 1943, before the bomb was ever built, people recognized the possibility that if you could use to produce a uranium gas, you could poison whole countries.
This was the Army knew this.
The Army knew this.
Groves knew this.
Yeah.
General Groves.
They knew it, and they wrote memos which have been preserved.
Mm-hmm.
And they were undug by people, and they were literally talking about using it not only on the battlefield, but, you know, to make a certain area uninhabitable.
Yes.
And so that's what we're now using in Iraq, okay? That's what we've been using in Iraq. Right now there's no tank battle, so they're not using it at the moment. But they contaminated the entire Near East, Afghanistan and Iran, and many other countries, because this stuff travels now all over the world. It's like a gas. It's not like ordinary dust that falls down very quickly, but it gets carried around the world.
There's Kosovo, and
all those
what
places.
Are the places? Lorraine.
Afghanistan, Bosnia.
Bosnia.
It was even used in
Chechnya.
Serbia.
Yeah.
In Chechnya.
And in the United States.
Right.
In places like Jefferson Proving Ground in Indiana.
And the
Fallon, Nevada.
Fallon, Nevada.
Yeah, and the worst one that I discovered so far is Puerto Rico, where they have the highest rates of diabetes in the entire nation.
Wow.
And listen to this. A peak of diabetes occurred in Hawaii and Alaska and along the seashore of this nation a year or two after the enormous uses in Iraq.
Oh, this is this latest paper that came out. And
yes.
Loren wrote about it.
Yes. Busby,
it just happens to be on mindfully.org.
My friend Chris Busby.
I have that as well, yeah.
Okay, he has now shown that the British government measured the increase in radioactivity from 100 units to 600 units. A five-fold increase
during the time this happened.
Yes, within a few weeks, within 9-10 days after the biggest bombing took place, okay? And so we are now contaminating Hawaii, Alaska, and places like Puerto Rico, and our own places all over, even the mountains here, where I just flew over. Because I saw the snow, and that's where it is brought down.
Japan as well.
And Japan, of course, all over. And in fact, in Japan, the diabetes rate has been rising faster than here.
Really?
And it's now twice as many people dying and having illnesses of diabetes in Japan than in the United States.
Now, this might be related to your power plants.
Not all of it.
No.
Because it's often synergistic interaction, too. Because they have different isotopes working on different parts of the body that weaken you, and then it prevents you from fighting off diseases in other cases. So these things all interact. And one other thing I found, China has practically no nuclear plants. I think there are 4 nuclear plants. We have 103 or 104 operating now. In China, they have 3 or 4 operating now. They're talking about maybe building many more. But the Chinese cities have higher diabetes rates even than Japan.
Well, why is that?
Because the Chinese themselves did a lot of bomb testing in the Gobi Desert. And a lot of it is still around. And it affected them in ways they never fully appreciated. And furthermore, they're getting it even now from Iraq, from the stuff that keeps blowing all around the world. And they detonated their bombs in the hope it would go elsewhere. Most of them were done near Tibet, near the Himalayan mountains. And much of it went into India and the Tibetans. But very often it went into the cities and to the great rivers.
Yeah,
and the great rivers poisoned the people in Burma, and on and on. So it is clear. My message is simply this:
yes.
We totally mistook our data on X-rays and mistook, thought that it was the same action as radioactive particles. Now we know that radioactive particles are destroying the world. They're destroying the fish. They're destroying the coral. They're destroying the deer. Many frogs are dying all over the world in places where there's nothing around. But the uranium oxide dust goes everywhere because it's like a gas.
Now, it's not pulled down out of the atmosphere.
That's right.
By gravity.
No, it's not, because the particles are too small. And Brownian motion, the motion of the molecules, keeps knocking them around, and they stay afloat.
They're so light.
They're so light.
That
like
other
little molecules, almost.
Yeah.
They're like molecules.
So then they come down with the rain.
Exactly.
Or just
and they
by
poison
chance.
The world, exactly, all over the world.
Yeah.
And the New York Times had a big article about this only a few weeks ago. Okay? And so this is the time
that's,
to talk
that's
about
that's what Loren's handing me here, the New York Times article.
Yeah, what year, what day was it?
This is January 9th, 2006, a Monday.
Yeah, just a few weeks ago.
What I'm looking at is diabetes and its awful toll quietly emerge as a crisis.
Exactly. Yeah. And the greatest crisis is among the poor. Because, for many reasons, it's very interesting, not only do the poor have poor medical care and poor diet, but we found that the government once had a program for protecting farmers from bad milk. Okay, in the 1930s, under Roosevelt's time, they instituted a program where it would take milk that wasn't tasting so good and mixed it with other milk and shipped it around the country. Okay. This way the farmers didn't starve when their milk didn't taste
good. It wasn't diseased. It was just the taste.
Mm. That's all we knew in 1930.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time ago, before we did bomb testing. Mm. That only started in 1945,
Mm-hmm.
Historically, we don't realize that. And so what they did now recently, the states that have the biggest nuclear reactors used it to ship it out of their state into places that need the milk, like Washington, D.C., that has no cows of its own.
Mm-hmm.
And it also has a large black population, okay,
mm-hmm.
that eat all the bad foods and don't have very good medical care.
They don't have access to
right.
foods.
It's a very high proportion of blacks, very poor. And now Virginia and Pennsylvania and New Jersey, to protect their own people, move the milk from around shipping, especially around Three Mile Island and Peach Bottom and other reactors within 50, 100 miles of Washington, D.C. Sometimes it travels hundreds of miles, thousands of miles, and they ship it into places that need the milk.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, the highest rate of diabetes in the nation and the highest cancer rates, okay, we find in Washington, D.C. And so we are killing our own. And that is a form of genocide, because it's deliberate shipping contaminated milk into the inner cities of New York and Baltimore. And where do they ship it? In Pittsburgh, where I live, they ship it into the Hill District, which is 99% black. And there's not one supermarket, not one Giant Eagle where I go shopping in the black supermarket. And so we are slowly and, in effect, extinguishing, damaging entire generations of minorities all over our nation in the interest of keeping the secret of what radiation really does.
And profit. Profit from...
And protecting your own.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you live, like I live in Washington, you know, I lived in Washington once, and I lived in Pittsburgh for years. I don't go to the black district to buy my milk.
My goodness. Yeah. Well, what I have to close this right now, but what can we close this? What kind of advice can we give to
people? Well, the advice is that we must develop alternative ways of using, producing electricity, and we must convert the existing nuclear plants to natural gas, of which we have a lot, and, you know, it's of course it's expensive, but human life on a large scale is much worse, and therefore, and it's been done in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
a nuclear plant that gave trouble called Fort St. Vrain has been converted to natural gas, and other places in the world have done the same thing. And we can do that because otherwise our health care costs are going to completely destroy our nation. It used to be 2 or 3% of our national income. Now it's 15% and
mm-hmm.
continuously rising
mm-hmm.
with conditions like diabetes and children being born underweight and becoming autistic and all the various troubles of children in school and their learning abilities and the future of being able to compete with countries that don't have milk and they don't have many nuclear reactors like China.
What about people on the street? What can they do? I mean, what can a mother with four or six children
can call up her congressman, and can write a note to the papers. It can participate in environmental groups and movements and force the government eventually, but I'm afraid we will be the last nation to shut down our nuclear reactors. Italy has done it. Austria did it. Norway never wanted to do it. Sweden has determined that in another 20 years they will replace all coal and nuclear energy with alternative wind and solar and geothermal and ocean movement energy, and that has to be the future, or else we are destroying not only ourselves, but the coral and the fish and the birds, okay? And all over, we are destroying our planet.
Yeah. Well, I need to stop the program here. And it was a pleasure speaking with you, Dr. Sternglass.
Thank you.
Pleasure getting to shake your hand finally, too. Thank you.